The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Improvisation at the world-famous Second City Theater. This podcast is about navigating work and life without a script. Improvisation is a practice in collaborating more effectively, tapping into your full creative potential, and building ensembles who can both support and challenge us. If you like what you hear, please rate us on iTunes and share the podcast through your social media channels. Help us extend the conversation. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tight and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Howard Yu. Howard is the LEGO Professor of Management and Innovation in the prestigious IMD Business School in Switzerland, as well as the director of its signature program, the 3-week Advanced Management Program, an executive education course. In 2015, Yu was selected by Poets and Quants as one of the world's top 40 business professors under 40. And in 2018, he appeared on the Thinkers 50 radar list of 30 management thinkers most likely to shape the future of how organizations are managed and led. He has delivered customized training programs for leading organizations, including Mars, Daimler, and Electrolux. His articles have appeared in Forbes, Fortune, Harvard Business Review, the Financial Times, and the New York Times. Yu received his doctoral degree from Harvard Business School. Prior to beginning his doctorate, he worked in the banking industry in Hong Kong. He has a new book. It's called Leap: How to Thrive in a World Where Everything Can Be Copied. Howard Yu, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
In the introduction to your book, you talk about how, being born and raised in Hong Kong, you were witness to, quote, the inevitable migration of knowledge and capital, end quote, which is kind of the launching off point for the book. So can you tell us about what happened in Hong Kong and how it informs the thesis of Leap?
Sure. So I remember when I was growing up, Hong Kong is being seen almost the pearl of the East. Is the model of economic development. And the big, big industry at the time, it was light manufacturing sector, yeah. Toy, garments, and so on. And at one point, Hong Kong really became the world's largest toy exporter. Hmm. And then very rapidly, I remember the entire manufacturing cluster imploded. Job moved away and moved across the border to China. And the kind of optimism that characterized Hong Konger for so many years simply disappeared. Mm-hmm. And I still remember when we were graduating from college, we were already talking about reinvent ourselves. You got to upgrade your skills and so mm-hmm. on. That's decades before any free market economist would worry about the disadvantage of outsourcing, the problem with latecomer firm competing and becoming jobless society. But I was growing up with that particular scenario. Wow. And so I have always been thinking about how come jobs and know-how and industry seems to be so transient. They move from one city to the next, to the next. It's sort of like the textile industry. It started from the UK, moved to the US, and then Japan, Taiwan, Hong Kong, and now it's all across China, Bangladesh, and India. So that becomes the thrust for me to understand how do company can prosper and thrive, not just the next quarter, not just the next year, but decades and centuries?
Yeah, and so in this book, there's so many principles I want to dig into. But what I also want you to tell the story, because I think it's very salient and it's why you begin with it, is this cautionary tale about Steinway & Sons, the legendary maker of grand pianos. So what can the arc of Steinway's business history teach us?
Yeah, so when I talk to senior executives, oftentimes when they see the pressure of there are latecomers entering the industry or there are lower cost competition entering their own sector, the knee-jerk reaction is, I'm going to become the Rolex of my own sector. Yeah. I'm going to move high-end and make the best machine or products possible. And Steinway & Son becomes a cautionary tale because they do make the best piano in the world. They dominate the concert grand piano sector, and pianists love their product. Mm-hmm. However, if you're looking at the financial result over the last five decades, it's a disaster, despite mm-hmm. they make the best product ever. The company gone private by private equity firm, and they gone relisted, and go private again. And throughout all this time, at its peak, they were selling around 6,000 piano per year, down to 2,000. Historically, they owned 400 acres of land at the tips of Astoria, and over the years, they were forced to sell out this land holding just to stay liquid, and today, they're left with one factory complex. Now, the workers and management team still continue to be very passionate about making piano, but the financial results simply couldn't sustain the enterprise in terms of growth and long-term prosperity. And what really ultimately have disrupted Steinway and Son is not technologies. The way you make piano is the same, but it's Yamaha from Japan. Hmm. Now, after Second World War, Yamaha came in, and they were making the upright piano, very different than Concert Grand. But over time, they automate their manufacturing processes. They put in conveyor belt, large-scale manufacturing. So they build up the financial balance sheet, becoming the world number one instrument makers. Now, by the time they entered the Concert Grand, by the late 60s, they have so much more cash, they have such a stronger financial balance sheet, it becomes almost impossible for Steinway to fight back. So in short, Steinway, inadvertently, they were trapped in the golden cage. So it is a cautionary tale for executives to remember, even when you make the best product, if you couldn't fundamentally change the way you work and deliver those services or offering, you become very vulnerable for latecomer to capture the value of your own industry.
Yeah, so the idea here is that your very expertise can be the problem that won't allow you to scale. You have a great quote where you say, quote, what you see depends on where you stand. And I guess sometimes if you're standing at the top, you're not seeing anything.
Absolutely, right? And so it's this idea that if your industry knowledge stays stagnate, it's almost like climbing up the mountain. Mm-hmm. Everyone is trying to reach the mountain peak. If the knowledge discipline of the industry stays stagnate, sooner or later, the latecomer can reach the same height as the pioneering company. So there is no value proposition will stay unique forever. There is no blue ocean can stay blue. Ultimately, every market space would turn red. And so it's this idea, how do you leap from one knowledge discipline to the next so that you can reinvent the way a product or offering is set up in the marketplace? That turns out to be the fundamental principle for organization to stay on top of competition.
And I want to talk about some of those ways that you leap, but another problem that you've got, and this really spoke to me because I work at Second City, which you know we are the biggest brand in our very very little specific area of improvisation based comedy. And you write in the book that you got to recognize, quote, the importance of embracing self-cannibalization, which is something that we always talk about, with not wanting to cannibalize ourselves. But what you're suggesting in this book is that if you're looking to scale, you are going to have to cannibalize yourself.
Right. And this is very, very critical, because what we found is whenever a company is on the verge of leap to a new knowledge discipline, the benefit becomes very, very difficult, or if not impossible, to quantify into traditional financial analyses. And I give you a quick example. Procter & Gamble, for example, mm-hmm. they've been making natural soap using animal fat and vegetable oil. And around the 60s, they discovered they came up with the first synthetic detergent, which ultimately becomes the Thai brand. Now, going down that path of coming up with synthetic detergent, there is almost this compulsive fear inside Procter & Gamble, because managers are fearful that it's going to destroy the Ivory Soap, their blockbuster brand. Mm-hmm. But then at that time, the chairman of the board, he basically said, if anyone is going to destroy our natural soap business, it better be P&G. And so they went ahead and launched a Thai brand and become U.S. number one category seller. And in the wake of launching a Thai brand, their technical staff also tripled. So moving away from the traditional soap-making principle to embrace this idea of using organic chemistry to develop the next generation of household cleaning products. So every single time when we're looking at company capable of leaping to a new knowledge discipline, they do have to embrace the concept of self-cannibalization, because it's so hard to render this financial benefit into a regular Excel spreadsheet analysis.
And I think it's important to recognize, too, it's not like Ivory Soap went away. It's still on the shelves. They certainly, it's you know, tide, you know, went bigger. But you actually make a strong point about this book is that you don't throw away your core competency, but you sort of build adjacent skills to it. So you want to build on the shoulders of your past work.
That's right. Now, so product would die, but capability doesn't. So the idea here is, when you leap to a new knowledge discipline, doesn't mean that what you've learned from the past becomes useless. Because for pharmaceutical industry, for example, over the course of 200 years or so, they really migrate from organic chemistry to the study of microbiologies to today is all genomics. Every time when company move from one knowledge discipline to the next, what they know in the past actually becomes very important. In fact, it's because the biologist can pour in chemical dye on top of the bacteria, then they discover the DNA structure. Mm-hmm. So this idea that you've got to master the old knowledge discipline in order to reinvent new one is actually quite a good news to manager and executive at large, because so much work has been done around innovation. They sort of describe the picture as, it's always the disruptor is going to win. It's always the new entrant is going to win. And what I'm trying to illustrate is, yeah, if left unmanaged, that is the normal consequences. But if managers are able to embrace self-cannibalization, if they are paying attention of where to leap to the next, in fact, it's the most experienced pioneering company would stand a better chance to stay on top of competition, as illustrated by the pharmaceutical industry. All of the pharmaceutical industry companies, top the industry leader, they have been around for hundreds of years. Mm-hmm. It's not the latecomer from Asia who dominate that industry at all.
Right. All right. So if you buy in the idea that you have to be wary of your own expertise, you have to be able to be open to self-cannibalization, which makes perfect sense. Then you talk about the decision-making process inside a company. And this, mm-hmm. this I know for a fact, because I've lived it in my own business and seen it in others, that you know, top-down decision-making is right. Generally how it's done. And you suggest, and I think the science suggests, that's not the way that you're going to invent and be successful in scale.
Right, right. So it really required a nuanced combination between bottom-up and top-down approach. Mm-hmm. Now, because every time when the company needs to reinvent itself, there's so much unknown out there, and you don't even know what you don't know. And so experimentation, rapid prototyping is very, very important to reduce the dark space of ignorance and to generate evidence as well. But at some point, what we observe is the senior management team also need to move this emergent strategy into much more deliberate choice, because as an operating company, you cannot just keep on experimenting with no end. At some point, the CEO needs to say, money doesn't matter, let's full steam ahead, based on real clear evidence. Mm-hmm. So again, in Novartis, when they begin to launch the very first targeted drugs based on genomics, moving away from the traditional microbiology principle, the market estimation of these new targeted drugs wasn't that big. In fact, by logical, rational calculation, Novartis should spend most money to other disease class. But the CEO, Daniel Venzeller, saw all this evidence suggest that genomics is going to fundamentally shift the way drug discovery is going to be conducted. He told his top team, money doesn't matter, full steam ahead. So it's this idea of combination between experimentation bottom-up in the beginning, and at some point, based on early evidence, then they require a set of top-down intervention. I call it CEO deep dive. It's really the CEO dive deep into the content of the strategy. It's not so much about micromanagement, but still, if with these type of intervention, then you can overcome organizational inertia.
Yeah, because what you're suggesting, and I think the science backs us up, is that leaders inside an organization are at best guessing as to what strategy might work. And if you want to do this scientifically, you have to experiment to get the most evidence possible. So you're kind of you're doing and then cementing later.
That's right. And I mean, one of the biggest paradoxes I observe in big companies is big companies or even small companies, they are willing to put a lot of experimentation within the four walls of R&D, mm-hmm. the laboratory. But the moment we ask managers to conduct experiment in the marketplace, they get panicked.
Yeah.
They were willing to spend millions of dollars within the R&D lab, and they weren't willing to spend tens of thousands in the marketplace to hash out an experiment with the correct business model. And that disjoint, I think, is what I'm trying to get at, and to get managers to understand, well, you know, commercialization also requires a lot of experimentation. But of course, once the evidence is clear, then you pull the trigger and move into a deliberate strategy.
And then along the lines, when we talk about execution, you say quite simply, quote, thinking doesn't equate doing.
Right.
How do people get caught up between those two things?
Yeah, so in many ways, company oftentimes would like to run workshop. They invite external speakers or consultant expertise to really generate a lot of awareness and curiosity or commitment for change. But that doesn't equate to orchestrated, coordinated action. Is oftentimes managers would go offsite, becoming energized. They have a new strategic vision, and yet they go back to the existing routine. And so a lot of waste of energy and time that I see happening among big companies and complex organizations. So it's this idea that once you have a shared language, once you understand where we need to go forward, then it's beginning of time to allocate resources to certain experiment, to have a review mechanics. If we are not going anywhere, let's shut it down, move our resources across to other initiative quickly, and then if certain initiative now beginning to generate evidence, then let's scale this big. And it's this idea of scaling disruption bigger inside a large firm usually is the biggest challenge. It's not so much around the lack of idea, or it's not the problem of lack of small little pockets of success, but it's how do you scale up excellence. That usually is the biggest challenge for a company when they try to reinvent themselves.
It's interesting as you're talking, because I didn't make a note of this or even pick it up in the book, and maybe it's not there, maybe it is, but it seems to me what you're saying is that the same sort of process that you're talking about that leadership has to go through in their decision-making process, it really mirrors the process by which you put your product out, which is this constant toggle between developing insights and evidence and experimentation. And it's like it goes back and forth, back and forth, back and forth until you get a place where you feel comfortable and right to move forward.
Yeah, absolutely, right? So one is from the product aspect, you've got to experiment with the marketplace and so on. But in many ways, when you lead an organization, then the idea is, you know, for experimentation, you could do an aggregate resource allocation plan. You earmark certain budget, and you don't need to tell your investors, right? You can do a skunk work, you can put it in the dark boxes, and you can experiment. But try not to just experiment within the laboratory. Use those resources to help it to getting into the marketplace. Now, the other part of the conversation becomes when this new thing beginning to gain traction, then we've got to figure out the capital investment. Don't get too obsessed about everything we need to fund it in-house, because these days, open innovation is key. How can we build an ecosystem and leverage the platform out there is also critically important. 30, 40 years ago, you can reinvent everything in-house. Today, you've got to leverage the crowd out there.
Hmm. Yeah, very true. All right, I want to talk about you. The final sort of chapter of the book talks about computers. And early on in this chapter, you say, quote, computers used to be human. So explain that.
A computer used to be?
That they used to be human.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, It is. A computer used to be a job description. In fact, you know, when AT&T begins to build up the telephony system and the first mainframe computer first coming along, and there was a time that big company would hire a team of people doing simple calculation. And historically, this tended to be female job because of gender inequality. And they are really just doing simple calculation. And it's only much later than the modern computer becomes taking hold to modern workplace, then we see that starting to become machine. Now, of course, these days, what really interesting is machine is no longer dumb machine. They don't just follow people's instruction. In fact, the whole idea around artificial intelligence and deep learning is that machine for the first time can figure out a strategy and undergo unsupervised learning. Now, all of these becomes feasible because of the advanced computing power. Every 24 months, computer-based computing power basically double. Mm-hmm. And so 10 years ago, AI feels like sci-fi. Today is very, very real. And so the implication becomes, we as human manager, how do we make sure we build a talent pipeline or job description so that they are not dead-end job? Is a moral obligation for executives to thinking about when they hire recruit and so on. How do we craft a job description to harness that human creativity? How do you build up a job that are general purpose enough that won't get replaced by a narrow type of AI expert system?
So, in fact, what you're saying is that we don't need to be afraid that the computers are going to take all our jobs, which is something you hear, because they can't really function at their best without a human interaction. I think you call it augmentation technology.
Exactly. So I remember speaking with a physician, and he's all for AI, right?
Yep.
And he was describing, you know, AI can never completely replace a physician, but it's going to change the nature of a doctor. Because when a patient coming in, you still ask, like, what's your pain? And the patient probably point to the stomach.
Yeah.
And the doctors still need to ask, like, is it your rib cage? Is it your lung? What's going on? And it's almost like this interaction between patient and doctors is like a detective work that the doctors need to gain trust from the patient and so forth and making sense of it. There's probably an AI for radiologists. There's probably an AI system for oncologists like cancer and so on. But each of these expert systems are narrow field. But for a doctor or physician's role is to integrate these activities or integrate all this domain of knowledge and do the final sense making. So it requires human empathy, the understanding of human emotion, gaining trust, networking. All of these probably find it so hard to be replaced by a robot or a machine. So the role of the doctor would be very massively different. Same thing for human manager. Going forward, jobs like Excel spreadsheet, massaging data, data entry, and things like that, that would get automated, no doubt. But what would open up is the human resources can be redeployed to do much more creative work. For example, understanding customer pain point, talking to customer much more in-depth, visiting them, to find out what are some of the unarticulated need that embedded sensor and big data still couldn't tell us. It still require human brain to understand exactly what is that critical pain point that the customer is facing and then reinvent new product and services and features. So it's really augmenting the managerial work in that domain.
So it's almost like the second machine age is going to allow human beings to be their most human. It's like we have to dig into what makes us most human, which actually feels like a good thing.
Yeah, and I mean, the implication becomes companies that can embrace AI and automate as much mundane work as possible, then they could free up their employees' attention and time to do the more creative work. And so the productivity per employee probably would go up. Company that couldn't embrace AI, they would get trapped with so much mundane work that they throw in human hand, trying to catch up, while the customer expectation is growing. So they will see the productivity per employee plummeted. And in fact, we have been already seeing this divergent gap or widening gap of corporate performance already because of this convergence of smart machine and connectivity. So the effect is very, very real.
You have a really lovely sentence on this where you say, quote, a computer can play chess far better than it can recognize the face of its opponent. And I think that that kind of says it all. All right. I'm going to ask you in a second for your yes and story, which we ask every guest. But before we do that, there was one other little section in the book that I wanted you to talk a bit about, because you talk about the difference between mysteries and puzzles. The quote I pulled here was, unlike the solution to a puzzle, the answer to a mystery simply doesn't yet exist. It has to be invented. So what's the context that you're talking about mysteries and puzzles with this conversation?
Yeah, so in many ways, solving a puzzle is easy. There are difficult puzzles, but there is a predictable way to solve those puzzles.
Right.
So imagine if you are trying to improve an existing product category, you can do customer survey, you can try different kind of price point and so on, and begins to see perhaps the sales volume begins to improve. A mystery, in contrast, is that there is no tangible way or rules to go about. In short, you need to step back and fundamentally reimagine a new solution. So I have been exploring an NGO in New York, and they were trying to solve homelessness problem. And somehow they were running into this mystery that despite all these resources flowing at the city level, that there's still this group of chronic homeless people don't receive services. Now, it turns out there is a group of population homeless people. They simply refuse services. Now, historically, nobody tried to tackle them. Nobody's trying to understand what's going on. But then they see this challenge as a mystery. As a result, the team decided to let go of everything that they know, act as if completely innocent, and go in and talk to them, interview them, observe them. Now, it turns out what these group of homeless people want, they do want housing, but they don't want service. They don't want shelter and so on. As a result, the new offering that they came up with is to remove, we call it, the barrier to consumption. Every barriers that forbid these chronic homeless people to getting into a house, they systematically remove them. And this is a way of reconceptualize a mystery, letting go of the existing rules of the game so that you can really tackle a complex and intractable problem. Again, solving a mystery is probably uniquely human. Solving a puzzle, you can turn it to IBM Watson.
So interesting. All right. We end every podcast where we ask our guests to share a yes and story. So in the province of improvisation, you can't get anywhere by saying no, and you can't say yes, but you have to say yes and.
Sure.
And I'm wondering if you have a yes and story from either your work or your life that you could share with us.
So that's actually the job that I'm now doing with the AMP program. So it's a 3-week long executive education program. And I was asked to whether I would like to lead that program. I was having enough teaching load at that time, and I thought I shouldn't. But then I said yes and, because I thought, you know, I've been at IMD for 6 years, why not try it? And once I try, it's scary. For the first few runs, I get burned, and learning a great deal, and it's really learning how to take executive through a 3-week long journey, so that they don't just open their mind, but they have something really tangible to bring back to their organization and change the way they work. It turns out probably is the best thing that I signed up with since I joined IMD 8 years ago.
That's great.
I don't know.
That's perfect.
Does it work?
Yeah, that's perfect.
Okay.
The new book is called Leap, How to Thrive in a World Where Everything Can Be Copied. Howard Yu, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you so much. It's my great pleasure to be here.